Did you know that the oldest German Protestant church in Michigan was built right here in Ann Arbor? Well, it was. Headed by the Reverend Friedrich Schmidt, the first German church was built in 1833 on the west side of town. As you can see, it was a modest, single-story log cabin. The German settlers named it Zion Church, and because they were the first established congregation in Michigan, and because Pastor Schmidt was the only German minister for miles around Ann Arbor, the church became the center of much of the religious activity in this part of the country. The congregation grew rapidly until in 1845, it was decided that a new church should be built closer to town. It was named Bethlehem Church and is today known as Bethlehem United Church of Christ, where your host was senior minister for 5 years. Mr. and Mrs. Emmanuel Hayes have attended Bethlehem Church since the early 1900s. Mrs. Hayes described briefly the old German rite of confirmation.
I was confirmed in German, but when we had our catechism, Reverend John would explain it in English. That's how I could understand it much better. We all could understand it much better. But when we were confirmed, we're still confirmed in German, and I think that was one of the last times. After that, there's only a couple more that he confirmed, a couple more years that he confirmed in German.
Benny, you served on the church council.
Yes, I served 2 terms on the church council, and I had about 17 and a half years on the cemetery board.
What were some of the big issues that you had to deal with in those?
Well, the first time I was on, the big issue was the parish hall. That was started. And the late Alfred Walker would happen to be chairman of the church council, and I was secretary, and we were authorized to sign the contract with the James Spirit Company to build the parish hall.
And that is a parish hall. I think it's the only one in the city that has a gymnasium in it, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Was Dr. Schmale the minister here then?
Yes, Dr. Schmale. He came in 1928.
1939 was a particularly memorable year for Mr. Hayes, as he recalls the renovations of the Bethlehem Church.
I remember that year very well. We renovated the church. We put glass on the outside of all windows, and we lowered the organ. And we put in a new chancel, and we painted the interior of the sanctuary, and the painter gave us $500 off if we do the work with our and scaffold, put the scaffolding up. Of course, them days you had to use lumber. They didn't have these portable scaffolds they have now. So we went to Fingerland Lumber Company and borrowed the lumber. And one Saturday morning, about 75 men came there, and they put up that scaffold, and at 2 o'clock it was done. It was all up, that scaffold. Of course, the painter sent a man to supervise the job, but everybody worked.
Like the Bethlehem Church, the Second Baptist Church, headed by the late Reverend Charles W. Carpenter, also had many hardworking members. And perhaps no one worked harder than Mrs. Carpenter, the minister's wife. She described to us what it was like in terms of her duties.
Strange or odd to me in becoming a minister's wife, being so active in the church from early girlhood, that meeting the public and being thrown in with various groups, it came very natural to me. And being a minister's wife or marrying a minister, there is a difference being a minister's wife and the wife of a minister. I wanted to be more than just the wife of a minister. I wanted to really be a minister's wife, which to me was more significant than just being married to a minister. And as a minister's wife, I felt it was my place to be a real helpmeet to my husband. Because I felt like if any phase of the work in the church failed, that meant that my husband failed. One thing I did, perhaps in the year of 1940, after coming to Ann Arbor, I got the little children together and organized a choir of the little children. And I called that choir, I named the choir the Blue Crown Choir. The Blue Crown Choir. And the reason I named them that was because of the attire they wore. I had little blue crowns made for their heads, and their robes was blue, the undergarment, and the top part was white. And that's why I named them the Blue Crown Choir. That was step number one, which from, I shall say, the year of 1940, right on up to 66, when Reverend Carpenter retired from the pulpit at that time, the Blue Crown Choir was active. And another thing that I was just very active in, working with not only the children, but also adults in Second Baptist Church. Another group that I organized was called the GAs, that's the Girls Auxiliary. And we were known by the uniform that we wore, the Girls Auxiliary, which was a group. It was a part of the missionary movement. And then the Shepherd Boys League was the boys, because they were not in with the girl. I became superintendent of the Sunday school, that is the primary department. I had each age level of the children, but I did not have the adults under my supervision. We took we included from the cradle roll right on up through high school, that department.
One of the biggest problems that the church has had to face over the years is prejudice. Mrs. Carpenter explained how her husband dealt with this.
I've had people to say these situations changed through Reverend Carpenter, the stand that he took. Because when he would be asked to speak at these various meetings, he would tell them in no uncertain terms. You know, he would let them know. And so I've had the white people, many of them, even since he's been gone, to say that it was through Reverend Carpenter that conditions have changed. He told me, this is before my time, that they went into a store up here on Main Street, I think it was an A&P, and they were reluctant, the clerks were reluctant, cashiers were reluctant to serve his wife, to wait on her, you know. And they would accept some of the white customers ahead of her, you know. And then when they did serve her or wait on her, they just threw it at her like that. Well, he reported it. And in two or three days, that person was gone. They didn't have a job. But it was only by the stand he took. Didn't have a job. He would go in places, and he has been, yes, he's been discriminated against, and to be served, and they would act like they didn't want to serve him. He'd sit there, and he'd sit there. They'd walk around, and the waitresses would walk around, and other people would come in, and they'd serve them. He'd still sit, and he'd sit. I think this happened even in Detroit at J.L. Hudson's, I believe. Yes, they had a cafeteria there. And so he got up, and then he went for the manager. And he reported it to the manager. Well, in a few days, that waitress was gone. She was gone. And it's these things that broke down that prejudice line. You know, is by someone taking a stand in this way.
Like Reverend Carpenter, Mr. Osias Wirdling has been a leader of his people, the Jewish community. When he arrived in Ann Arbor in 1903, there were only three Jewish families in the area, and it was not until 1913 that the Ann Arbor Jewish population began to organize. Mr. Swerdling explained how the Beth Israel Congregation, as it is now called, was started.
It's like the Lord's way that it so happened that the Rabbi Joseph Sloman came from Jerusalem to go to Chicago to raise some money for that time for Jerusalem, for the poor people who at that time well, just had a very hard time. And on the way from Chicago, going to Detroit, there was an accident near Chelsea. Two interdriven cars got together, a collision. The rabbi's son who was with him was killed, and he was badly hurt. So they called me past midnight from the University Hospital that they cannot communicate with him, and he was not in a condition where they could put him to sleep. So they wanted to know whether I would come down. So the doctor came down for me, and as I went up on the third floor of the old hospital in Kettlestead, not on N Street, there was a rabbi with his eyes closed and his arms stretched out praying the Hebrew. See, I touched his hand and I said, Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you. And then he opened his eyes wide and started to thank God that he has somebody he can communicate with. So it went down. We used to take care of him, the dietary laws, because he couldn't eat anything in the hospital. And every Sunday, my wife and I used to go down and have a long visit with him. He was getting along better until the month before the high holidays. We found him in tears. And when we were asking him, he says, well, I've been in this place praying by myself all these months. Now it goes to the high holidays. And I must pray with a quota, with a minion, as you said. I says, that's impossible. We don't have enough even with you. He says, hey, what do you do? I told him, we go to Detroit. I will go too. But he was no position to leave. So I talked with the doctor, and he absolutely forbade it. So my wife and I decided you should take him to our home and bring another two Jewish men from Detroit, and also got the school of the law, Torah, you know where the Torah is, and to our house, and I wheeled him to our home, and he stayed from the day before Rosh Hashanah, the first day. This is 2 days to the day after. The same thing for the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that's the way we had the first minyan in our house. It wasn't this house, it was in Liberty Street. And after that, that night, as we partook in, after fasting 24 hours, which you usually do, somehow, when he thanked me for being so kind, I got up and I says, well, it seems this is a miracle, and it's a sign from God that we must organize a Jewish community. We shouldn't have to go out from Ann Arbor. At that time, we had already, one of the families had a boy, the Bibel Mitzvah, to become for him, the 13 years old. And another one had a boy, got a Bibel Mitzvah. So we figured out we'd have a minyan. So the next minyan we had the following year was at the Salvation Army on North 4th Avenue, upstairs, second floor. Then we went to the arbiter, or means the workman's circles. They have a hall there on the west side. Then we had the, you know, ladies' library, which is the present where the telephone company is on East Jordan Street. And finally, we got together, the few of us, and we purchased a very dilapidated little place where it's now the Greek Church on North Main Street. And we had a man coming over who was doing everything. He was the cantor, he was the slaughter, you know, as you have to have a shochet with to make kosher chickens, other fowls. And he was also the teacher, everything. He and his family had a few rooms upstairs, and he was getting $18 a week. That's all he was getting. And so that went on. From there, we finally bought 538 North Division Street, which is now the St. Thomas Youth Center. We bought that building. We went with joy, carrying that Torah, singing. We had a big dinner there. And we were very happy there. Things didn't go smooth. Depression came. We couldn't continue to pay on that mortgage. Very heavy. But somehow, some way, the Lord was good to us, and we managed, we finally sold that place. And from then on, we went down to 2101 Hill Street, next to Dr. Bursley, who was the head of the men's student, you know. We bought a nice big home there. And I give you a capsule. And that's the way it started. Yes, and by 1916 we organized right in my home. at the first service that was in Ann Arbor for the high holidays.
That was in 1916?
1916. That's what he organized.
Among the many groups in Ann Arbor who do church-related work is Church Women United. The Ann Arbor branch of this national organization was begun 32 years ago by a few women who saw the need among church women of every faith for more active participation in religious and socially oriented questions. In the three decades of its existence, Church Women United has tackled issues like racial equality, civil rights, and world hunger. This next year, the group will conduct a study of the effects of human greed. Mrs. Nan Sparrow has been a member of Church Women United since it began in 1942. I asked Mrs. Sparrow exactly what the purpose of the organization was.
Protestant, Catholic, Roman Catholic, and Greek Orthodox women who meet together to worship and to enjoy fellowship and to serve the community, the local and the larger community.
How have Church Women United served the community here in Ann Arbor? I know that's a...
Well, let me say first what the worship consists
All
of
right.
now. We still have the World Day of Prayer in March. And then you asked what the activities were. We have three celebrations, as you probably know. In the fall, we have World Community Day, in which we all meet together to worship and to consider some world issue. This last time, for example, this last fall, the whole meeting was devoted to world hunger and the CROP organization that we've supported for many years, and the migrants. Then in the spring, in May, we meet together for May Fellowship, which considers the local scene, the local needs. I have found, and I've been with the Church Women United now for about 30 years, that they're way ahead of the community. They've got some very perceptive women at the head of it in the national. And these studies and books that they put out are forerunners of really what the problems that confront our society a little later.
There's an eye on the future then as
yeah,
to what's coming.
Yeah, sort of prophetic
towards.
In a way.
The Council of Churches, another ecumenically oriented group, was dissolved not long ago. The Reverend Howard Gebhardt, now associate pastor of Bethlehem United Church of Christ, was the last executive director of this council. I asked Mr. Gebhardt why the Council of Churches was disbanded.
We followed the pattern that is characteristic of councils of churches everywhere in the country at this day and time, so to speak, of taking a pretty good look at where we were and what we were doing and why we weren't getting any further than we were, apparently. And so we had a commission established to do some extensive study. We called it a New Directions in Ecumenism Task Force, and they undertook to figure out a better pattern for ecumenical work, cooperative effort in the community. Assuming that it would be best done on the task force basis, where groups of people would be organized to work around particular causes and tasks, and decided on this as a kind of a new image and a new entity, and established then, instead of a council of churches as such, the Center for Interchurch Cooperation, which is therefore the successor to the Council of Churches. And we now have an office in the Guild building, or whatever it's called, at the Baptist Church. It's over on Huron, the gray house that they have their offices in. We have an office there. We have a secretary at hand there, and we are continuing the ecumenical kinds of activities, such as the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which we're planning now for the 18th to 25th of January. We'll have extensive services and during that week, and we have continued some of the standard procedures of councils of churches, like Union Good Friday services, 3-hour service or an hour and a half, as the case may be, on a community basis. We had emphasis on Thanksgiving services in various ways. and in the meantime have task forces in being or in prospect that, which will be working around particular questions like institutional chaplaincies, the work of Christian education with retarded or handicapped people, like cooperative efforts in Christian education, the operation of a library of resources for Christian education, or choir music, or things of this kind, and anticipate getting into a number of areas of cooperative work. We work closely with the Church Women United and the Ministerial Association locally and other groups that have that are in being that have an ecumenical flavor. Oh, of congregations, as it's called now, the IFCC is a different and quite a different entity. This grew out of the time of the confrontations and the sit-ins takeover that came back in the end of the 60s when there were a number of problems evolved and there were those in the community who felt the churches as such were not really awake or aware of their responsibility to the poor and the disadvantaged and so on. And out of that situation developed then the Interfaith Coalition of Congregations, as it was first called, which began with some 10 churches banding together to cooperate in the raising of substantial funds to do some things for the poor and the disadvantaged in the community.
Today, there are over 70 religious bodies in Ann Arbor, each helping the poor and disadvantaged in its own way. Ann Arbor has indeed had a rich and colorful religious history. Enjoying the preaching of such distinguished ministers as Dr. Lemon, Ernest Campbell, Merrill Abbey, and Lloyd Douglas. But whether the sermons are preached by famous ministers or by alternating members of the congregation, the influence of the church is felt by nearly everyone around, and as shown by those we spoke with today, is a central place in the lives of many people. May the religious community prosper. I'm Ted Trost, wishing you all grace and peace.